Hi, this is Pastor Eric Dalma from Gospel of Grace Fellowship. It is our privilege to present to you this classic CIC radio broadcast. We pray that God uses it to encourage you in the gospel and equip you to discern truth from error.
This is Dick Cuffell, your host for the next half hour. We're speaking today with Bob DeWade, author of Critical Issues Commentary. Our topic today is Hebrews. We're beginning chapter 12. Robert, how about that? We went through chapter 11, and how many sessions did we do? I think it was 9.
Something like that.
Couldn't believe it. The reason I even mention that, folks, is when we first started doing this project, we had the idea that we would do 2 sessions per chapter and kind of do it in 26 sessions and make it kind of compact. It took us a whole session to do verses 1 and 2 of chapter 1, and we said, I think we're on a different path. And
well,
this is good.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm just not the person to do the Cliff Notes version of anything.
I think everybody who's heard this knows that.
I'm interested in everything I can possibly learn about whatever passage we're studying. It's just the way I am.
It's outstanding.
And these quick overview things are just not satisfying to me. So
that's not what we're about. That's
okay.
True. Well, as we step into chapter 12, there are some themes that we're going to see in the first 13 verses. What do you see?
Well, it starts out with an athletic metaphor,
okay,
like either a foot race or a boxing match.
Right.
Okay. And then it goes to the issue of discipline, and there's an analogy with fathers disciplining their sons, God disciplining his people, and that's a good thing, not something you get discouraged about.
Excellent.
And then it goes back into verses 12 and 13 to the athletic metaphor, sort of finish that theme off.
Perfect. Funny when you mentioned boxing match or a race.
Yeah.
If somebody challenged me to a boxing match, the first thing they'd have is a race because they'd have to catch me. Okay.
Hey, that's the way I was when I was a kid. I was a cross-country runner.
It's the only way to do it.
And these hostile bullies that wanted to fight, they weren't going to get me unless they could catch me.
That's the only way to do it when you weigh.
I weighed 140 pounds, you know.
That makes the difference. Okay, we have to settle into this. Chapter 11 is really a parenthesis, and if it is, let's go back to chapter 10 and read the last 4 or 5 verses from 35 through 39 and then start out. So let me read that. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 35 to 39. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. Okay, if Hebrews 11 is a parenthesis, what's the theme that's being picked up?
Well, Hebrews 11 was about faith, so both of these things were set up by verses 38 and 39. My righteous one shall live by faith. We are those who have faith. And then we have a whole chapter explaining what that means by using examples out of the Old Testament about how these people had faith, what it meant to them, how they lived it out. Now we're picking up the other theme, which is to not shrink back.
Excellent.
Okay, so we're in a difficult contest, and we have, as I said, an athletic metaphor. And you have to keep going. You cannot shrink back when it gets to be difficult.
We should probably set this setting for the community. When he's talking to them, why are they going to shrink back?
Well, because being a Christian at that point in history, and these were Jewish believers, meant coming under persecution. And you were not going to be popular, and you might even lose your life over it. And at any rate, you were persecuted, okay? Now, if you go back to the Jewish community and the temple sacrifices and the synagogue or whatever they had, you'd get rid of all your problems.
Right.
Other than the fact you'd be committing apostasy.
Exactly right. Let me read the first 2 verses of chapter 12. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. What's that first verse about?
Well, the cloud of witnesses is a reference to those who are mentioned in chapter 11. Okay?
All right.
And the idea would be a host of witnesses.
All right.
So we're supposed to think about the people that went before us, and they were, some of them enumerated in chapter 11.
Right.
Quite a few of them.
Right.
And emulate their faith. So the witnesses would be like the spectators in the arena or at the Olympics.
Right.
Okay. And it's not telling us that literally the people in heaven are watching us.
Okay.
But it's taking up this athletic metaphor and making the great people of faith the witnesses. And so we're to imagine they're watching us. Are we going to run the race in the manner that they did?
You know, I have a problem with that in the sense that we've talked many times about the idea that in heaven, those people are before God. They're not looking over our shoulder. Some of the religions that would sort of talk to those who have gone before us and have died and all that, you know, we throw that away. I'm looking at this and saying, well, then what's a witness? A witness is not just a person who's sitting there looking down. It's a person who has lived the life before, right?
Yes, and I've got a commentary here. No, I've got another commentary. You know, I just keep making my job more difficult by getting new commentaries.
You know, Lane, Lansky, and now who?
F.F. Bruce.
Oh, well, good one.
I just got this one. I got the new set of commentaries for my logos, and this one came with it.
All right.
Here's what Bruce says. But in what sense are they witnesses? Not probably in the sense of spectators watching their successors as they, in their turn, run the race for which they have entered, but rather in the sense that by their loyalty and endurance, they have borne witness to the possibilities of the life of faith. It's not so much they who look at us as we who look to them for encouragement.
I like that.
I like it, too. I think Bruce has got it right on.
Yeah.
Because, for one thing, life here on earth, even for faithful Christians, is kind of a mess.
Okay.
Okay.
I agree with that.
And I don't know that if, when you're in heaven, you're wanting to watch Christians muck it up.
I'm pretty sure it's not even an option.
Yeah, I don't think you would want to be watching that. I think it would. We just remind you, man, I wasn't that great either. God was very merciful to
me.
Right. So we shouldn't get over-inflated ideas about how perfected we are here. And to be in heaven and watching the yet-to-be-perfected saints struggle on earth probably wouldn't be much of a joy at all. So I agree with F.F. Bruce that we don't take that literally as they're watching us, but they're the exemplars, as we said.
Right.
And we should be inspired by the fact that we're in the same race they were in, and we would like to do well.
Exactly.
Maybe a better analogy would be like if you were a baseball player on something, let's say the Yankees, and you're in the World Series.
Right.
And you might think of Babe Ruth as an inspiration.
Sure.
It's not that Babe Ruth is necessarily watching the Yankees.
Right.
But the fact is what he did might inspire you to try to do something like that.
Exactly. Okay, I like that. All right. There's another portion of this. The community is being asked to lay aside all excess weight and the sin that so easily distracts us. That's a little bit of a change from what I read, but every encumbrance is what it was called, but it means excess weight.
Yeah, lay aside actually literally means take off.
But what is it?
Well, let's go to the metaphor first, and then let's talk about what the metaphor is referring to. The metaphor would be here a foot race, like they had in the Olympics, and back in those days, they ran naked.
That's getting rid of excess weight, okay.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have Speedo.
Right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you didn't want anything to slow you down.
All right.
So here, the excess weight to be taken off would be sin or fear or unbelief or any kind of thing that would hinder us in our race to be faithful Christians.
Well, I think love of wealth or attachment to the world, sure. Anything like that. All right.
Here's what Lane says about that. The combined expression covers any encumbrance that would handicap a runner. And by analogy, anything that would interfere with responsible commitment to Jesus Christ.
Ah, okay. Excellent. And the sin? What sin is he speaking of?
Well, Lane thinks that it's just concerned with sin itself, rather than some specific sin. And F.F. Bruce said the same thing.
Really, because they've spoken so much about apostasy. I thought they'd go that far.
Well, I've heard several things about this over my years of studying Hebrews, and I've been through Hebrews several times in my Christian life as far as teaching it and studying it.
Right.
The first thing I heard was, well, the sin must be unbelief, because that was faith was the topic of chapter 11.
Right.
But as a matter of fact, anything that would hinder us in our Christian walk and in participating in the race that would be sin would be an encumbrance that we should lay aside.
Okay.
So I don't know whether we enhance the verse by trying to make that specific.
I'm just looking at another note here, and it said, this is Lane, but he said apostasy would disqualify a Christian from running at all.
So that's true.
So it can't be apostasy. Okay, it's sin still in the race.
Right, if it was apostasy, you would be out of the race.
Right. Hebrews 12:1, the third part said, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. How does endurance through faith work?
Well, the idea here would be a long-distance race.
Sure.
Okay, not a sprint.
Right.
Okay, so a longer race required endurance, which is one of the key qualities that goes into running a long race. Now, I can speak about this because when I was in high school, I was a cross-country runner, and I used to run these long races.
Okay, yep.
And one thing I found out was don't worry about where you are at the beginning of the race.
Right.
Okay. Right. I remember one time my favorite race, the way we did it back then was we had these shorter races early in the season than longer ones.
Right.
So we started out with what they call a mile team race.
Right.
Well, one year, I was doing really well in the mile, and I loved that race. And we went to a big race at a college in Iowa with a whole bunch of teams there. And I was all charged up. I felt great. And at the beginning of the race, I just took off. And I out-sprinted everybody. I went all the way to the beginning. I got ahead of everybody in the whole race, like 130 people or whatever.
Right.
And I got about halfway through, and I ran out of steam, and these people started passing me. And every time somebody passed me, I got more discouraged. I ended up, it was one of my worst races and my worst times my whole senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned my lesson. Start at the back. It's better to be passing other people than have them passing you.
Pacing.
Yeah. Yeah, so the endurance is focusing on the goal and focusing on how you finish.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I learned. And so by the end of that same season, which was in 1969, we went to the state race, which was a two-mile race. They had an Iowa state law back then that you couldn't run over 2 miles in high school.
In high school, sure.
Yeah. And so we went up clear off to this other city, and there was 140 of the best runners from Iowa. Okay.
Whoa.
And I ended up 10th in that race, which was amazing.
That's terrific.
The best I ever did. But at that race, it was like the beginning. It was like pandemonium, and people were elbowing each other. And I just sat there. I started at the very end of our team and just let everybody take off and started slowly and then just spent my time passing people.
Beautiful.
And I passed. And I noticed that there was a great big hill just before the very end.
Perfect.
And I was watching some of the other classes. You know, they had a state meet, so they had different classes.
Right.
Everybody died on that hill.
Right.
So my whole goal was that when I got to the hill, that's when I'm going to sprint.
I'm going to sprint
up the hill.
Yep.
And I just whizzed by, I don't know how many people going up that hill. That's how I ended up with such a good finish for that race. But when I'm reading this, it brought back those memories that really our Christian life is not some sort of a sprint where you go 100 yards and you're done.
Right.
Okay, it's a long-term race. And there are a lot of obstacles,
right?
And there are a lot of things that can discourage you, and you have to be geared up for the long run with your eyes on the goal to make sure you make it all the way to the end.
Perfect.
And do your best in the process. And so that's what a distance race is all about. So you can't have things that distract. When it says the sin which so easily entangles us, there's a textual issue there, but both Lane and F.F. Bruce would translate it, easily distracts. So a distraction would be if you're supposed to be focused on a goal and you're looking over somewhere else.
Yes.
You get your eyes on the wrong place.
Right.
That'll distract you and you'll get beat.
Does that move us to verse 2, where it starts with fixing our eyes on Jesus?
Well, certainly. The goal is to be like Jesus. And then, so the distractions are a problem. Endurance is necessary. The word race, agon, a race that's run in a stadium is the imagery here.
Right.
Okay. And that is set before us, Lane translates as prescribed. Okay. Mm. So what that means is the course has been laid out and we have to follow it. Now, I was using my own cross-country experience. That's what they do. They go out on a golf course usually, and they'd put out these flags all around the course, and you had to stay on a certain side of those flags,
right,
or you'd be disqualified.
Right.
So you have to stay on the prescribed or laid out course and put all of your energy into it and focus on the goal and pace yourself to make it all the way and keep from looking at any kind of distractions. And it's amazing what can distract you. It doesn't take much.
Yes, that's true.
I remember one time we were running this race, and we used to run around at the football field in Sheldon, Iowa. They'd had a bigger course out there where the cross-country people would run.
Right.
And we'd be running out there. And the football team got to have music playing while they were practicing.
Right.
All right. Well, we were running one time, and they were playing a song back from the 60s, and it was a song that said, I'm so tired.
Everybody slowed down. Yeah,
it's like I could hardly run when they were playing that, and then they played some other up-tempo song, and I'd get taken off again.
Okay, but we have to move the segue then to the second verse, which says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. There's a lot there, but why the shift from the exemplars to Jesus?
Well, because he's the ultimate one.
Okay.
He's the ultimate person, sure, far greater than all of the people mentioned in chapter 11.
All right, and we're still back to the runner in the race, aren't we?
Yeah, the perfect one.
Okay.
By the way, Paul used the same kind of metaphor in 1 Corinthians 9, 24 and 25, which I would like to read.
Mm.
Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So there's a call where Paul uses the same kind of metaphor to point out the need for self-control.
Right.
And anybody that's ever been in any kind of athletics realize that self-control is absolutely necessary.
True.
If you're not going to discipline yourself and you're not going to work hard, there's no chance that you're going to compete.
It's true. Okay. Jesus was referred to as the author and perfecter of faith, and Lane says this means the champion of the exercise of faith and the one who brought faith to complete expression. Why does the writer need to explain Jesus in this way?
Well, in this case, I'm going to probably disagree with Lane.
Okay.
Okay, and here's why.
Okay.
Unless you take this verse to mean what he said.
Right.
There's nowhere in the Bible that it says Jesus exercised faith.
I agree with that.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, why? Because Jesus is not the subject of faith. He's the object of faith.
Exactly.
Okay. So Jesus, being one with the Father, doesn't need to exercise faith. Okay.
Okay.
And so,
but he's focusing on the fact that Jesus was the first to do the will of God perfectly.
Well, that part is true.
Okay. Now, is he equating that to faith?
Well, yes, and so does F.F. Bruce.
It's kind of a strange thing, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to agree with Lenski here, okay? I got to find somebody who agrees with me.
Okay. I see this pile that you're going through. Okay. Well, okay, now, what does Lenski do with it?
Let me just quote him. And he quotes some other authors from his day. When Moffat, like Delisch, makes Archegos the pioneer of personal faith, he disagrees with 2:10 and 5:9 with all the Greek exegetes who regard Archegos with itos, with the fact that Scripture nowhere speaks of Christ as a believer. Delisch states that this is the only place. With the second term, teleotes, which cannot mean that Christ is the completer of his own faith. An example for us likewise to complete our faith. So he says this is just not correct. And he's quoting Luther, and he said Luther is right. It means the beginner and completer of faith. Christ starts our faith and leads it to consummation.
You're going to have to explain that. That was a tough piece to listen to. What does it mean?
Well, it means that the completer would mean that if we keep our eyes on Jesus, our own faith will be brought to its perfect completion in the end.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, I like that.
So we keep our eyes on him, but not that Jesus was the one who showed what it meant to have faith, because that's a problem for me to say that, because it would be saying that Jesus is something less than God.
Yes.
Because God doesn't need to have faith. That's that word of faith here.
I'm just going to say we're getting back into something we don't agree with.
Yeah, and so God doesn't need faith because he's the one we have faith in. Jesus doesn't need faith because he's the one we have faith in.
Right.
So I'm going to agree with Lenski that this means that he completes our faith, not that he is the exemplar of faith himself. However, I'm disagreeing here with two really great biblical scholars of F.F. Bruce and William Lane, but sometimes we can't just rely on some certain person who we think is a good Bible interpreter. We've got to look at the evidence, and we've got to think of the whole counsel of God and what we know from elsewhere in the Bible.
I agree.
And so that one person that Lenski quoted said that, well, this is the only place where it says Jesus has faith, but it says it here. Well, not necessarily. Okay, so we fix our eyes on Jesus.
Right.
The author and perfecter of our faith. We wouldn't have faith if it wasn't for a work of God that he did by his grace.
Right.
But now we have another problem. Okay.
What would that be?
Who for the joy set before him.
Right. And what's the joy the scripture speaking of?
Well, that's the issue, because there's a word in the Greek, anti.
Okay.
And you can interpret that in various ways. Lane thinks rather than the joy, or rather than the joy that was within his grasp. So Lane would take it to be parallel to Paul's thoughts in Philippians chapter 2.
Which,
remember, Jesus, who had all the divine glories and everything in heaven, said came and took the shame and humbled himself, found the likeness of a man.
Right.
Okay. Well, here, Lane would think that this has to be that sort of thing. In place of the joy that was before him, that is, the joy he had in heaven, he came and endured the cross.
Okay.
That's how he interprets the Greek term anti.
Okay, and endured the cross.
Here's what F.F. Bruce says, and he's disagreeing with what Lane said, although he didn't interact with Lane because he wrote before that. He says this, quote, "It was sheer faith in God, unsupported by any visible or tangible evidence, that carried him through the taunting," which, by the way, remember, I've disagreed about the faith in God.
Right.
"The scourging, the crucifying, and the more bitter agony of rejection, desertion, and dereliction. Come down from the cross and we will believe," they said. Had he come down by some gesture of supernatural power, he would never have been hailed as the perfecter of faith, nor would he have left any practical example for others to follow. So his idea was that the joy set before him was the completion of his work of redemption.
Right.
And his exaltation to the right hand of God.
Okay.
And that goal was what he set his eyes on as he went forward and endured the shame and the bitter taunting and scourging and all the things that he went through, because his goal was the resurrection and the ascension to the right hand of God.
I think that holds together.
I think so, too.
That's good.
And, I mean, what Lane's saying is not false theologically, because Jesus did lay aside the joy he had with the Father to come here. But it seems to me that set before has to be a reference to something he's looking forward to, not something that happened in the past.
Okay.
So here, twice in one verse, I'm disagreeing with Lane.
Sorry. You know, we're called to be a Berean, just like the people that are listening to you preach on a Sunday, right?
Yes, and some of these passages are difficult anyhow.
Right.
Okay. And we should be gracious to people that see it differently, because especially if it's not leading to any actual theological error.
Right.
The idea that Jesus humbled himself and laid aside his divine glories, not his divine nature,
right,
to come here, is true.
Right.
But I think in this context, the set before, when you're thinking about fixing your eyes on a goal, it would have to be Jesus fixing his eyes on some goal that's for the future.
Excellent. Okay. Now, there's one more element, and that was despising the shame has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Despising the shame of the cross, I presume.
Yeah, that could be also translated disgrace.
Okay.
And despising could also be disregarding.
Right.
So not considering the horrible disgrace and shame that crucifixion was.
Right.
Okay, he was mocked. He was treated terribly and shamed as much as they could possibly put shame on him. And that was what the Romans liked to do. The reason the Romans crucified, they did the scourging. They made him carry the cross beam. They hung them naked on the cross. They shouted taunts at them. They put a placard about what their crimes were.
Right.
They wanted to create the most possible disgrace as possible. Why? Because in first century Middle East, they lived in an honor-shame society.
Okay.
And suffering shame was the last thing anybody ever wanted to have happen to them. Better to die in honor than to live in shame. That thinking is still true in the Middle East today, by the way.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the Romans knew that. And so by doing this crucifixion and doing it in a way that ridiculed and shamed the victim, they struck fear in the hearts of all of the people who would see this, because it was done publicly, where a lot of people would be. And because they hated to be shamed, that would keep them in line. They wouldn't do anything to cross the Romans because they didn't want to have that to happen to them.
That was going to be my question. This would be a crime deterrent.
Yeah, it was a crime deterrent, yeah. And especially against sedition against Rome.
Oh, yes.
And so if you create sedition against Rome, you will be shamed in the most ultimate way anybody could ever be shamed. You're living in a society where honor was the most important currency, more important than money, more important than anything else. And so to be shamed is to destroy your honor. And nobody wanted that.
Exactly.
And so here Jesus disregarded the fact that he was going to be shamed, and crucifixion was intended to maximize suffering and shame. But that was not the final word, because it says he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.
The next verse, verse 3, says, "For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." Obviously, we're speaking of Jesus, his endurance. By the way, this is the third time endured has been used in the first three verses. Interesting.
Yeah, so that's why we don't have a distance race.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, it's not about raw speed, it's about enduring.
All right. What's the state of the audience at this point, just to remind ourselves?
Well, they're considering quitting.
They're disheartened.
You know, hey, that happens.
Yep.
That happens.
Yep.
I've seen people drop out of these races when I was in cross country.
Right.
They'd get about halfway around and just say, okay, this is too much, and they'd just stop and say, I can't do this anymore.
I did a little running, and I did distance in my training, but not for racing.
I see.
I didn't like the attitude of runners in races. It's very aggressive. And it's like, hey, man, I'm limited. I don't care.
There's a lot of elbowing going on at the beginning.
But if you do the mistakes that you were talking about, they say a second too fast at the beginning is 2 seconds slower later in the race.
Absolutely. It took me quite a few years to learn that.
Well, anyway, there's pain in running.
Yeah, and you have to endure it.
Yep.
And sometimes when you get to the end, there's not one tiny bit of energy left. You're totally wasted, and you couldn't hardly even take a step. So,
well, he's making the exhortation that you may not become weary and lose heart now.
Interestingly, by the way, this whole analogy and the things that the author of Hebrews is saying,
right,
comes out of Hellenistic Jewish ideas expressed in their literature.
In what way?
Well, some of the same terms from the Greek and the same analogies are found in Maccabees when it talked about people that were tortured by their conquerors, Jewish people.
Oh.
And so I have here a citation. Now, Maccabees is not scripture.
Right.
but it's intertestamental Jewish literature that shows how Greek-speaking Hellenistic Jews express themselves
right.
and what their values were.
Right.
Okay, so let me read this. 4 Maccabees 17, and then I'm going 10 through 17 here. They vindicated their nation, looking to God and enduring, there's our word,
right.
torture even to death. Truly the contest in which they were engaged was divine. So here we have a contest.
Okay.
For on that day virtue gave the awards and tested them for their endurance. The prize was immortality and endless life. Eliezer was the first contestant. The mother of 7 sons entered the competition, and the brothers contended. The tyrant was the antagonist. The world and the human race were the spectators. There we have the witnesses.
Yes.
Reverence for God was victor and gave crown to its own athletes. Who did not admire the athletes of the divine legislation? Who were not amazed? The tyrant himself and all his council marveled at their endurance. So that was from intertestamental Jewish literature about the same idea that we find here in Hebrews.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
How do we link these first three verses with verses 4 through 13?
Well, he turns to exhortation. Actually, this is all exhortation.
Right.
But he's going to point out that they don't have it so bad, that they haven't been martyred. And God is allowing the suffering for a discipline in their life, and that there's a divine purpose in it, and they should endure it. That's what he's going to do.
But that's such an extreme. You don't have it so bad. You haven't been killed yet. You know, that kind of thing. You haven't shed blood.
That's what God said to Jeremiah when he complained.
But that's the point, right?
Yep.
Robert, we have a number of things that we still should comment on, and we're pretty much out of time today. What do you want to do?
Well, let's pick up verse 3 again next week and get into some of the issues in the grammar and what the author of Hebrews is saying in verse 3, and then we'll go on into that issue of discipline.
I think we have to talk about the hostility and a little bit about the exhortation. Okay, that's it for today, folks.
We're out of time for this edition of Critical Issues Commentary Radio. We want to remind you that you can access this program at our website at cicministry.org. We want to remind you of Philippians 1:27, stand firm in one spirit, with one mind, and strive together for the faith of the gospel.